The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, February 14th, the love edition, because what else would it be on Valentine's Day? I'm Hannah Rosen, the editor of XX. I'm joined today by Noreen Malone, who's a writer for The New Republic, and our special guest, Emily Offee, also known as Dear Prudy to Slate readers. We are not this week in our respective lonely recording studios, but on the stage at 6th and I, in front of a live audience, our first ever in Washington, D.C., who are going to show their existence to our listeners on the radio by... Yes, there they are. They are real, it is true. Today's topics are, one is the 50th anniversary of The Feminine Mystique, the most famous book to come out of the women's movement. The second is new research explaining why some kids crumble under testing pressure and others don't. And the third is a genuine live love advice session with Dear Prudy, who is here in the flesh to answer your questions. So let's jump in with The Feminine Mystique. Published in 1963, this book did not launch the women's movement, but it got many women on board with the revolution. It did that by convincing them that their lives were somewhat empty and that they suffered from what Betty Friedan famously called the problem that has no name, and they had to do something about it. But what was really radical about the book was its diagnosis. Friedan made it seem as if women were victims of a broad economic and cultural conspiracy, that magazines and corporations wanted to make them believe that their true purpose was to look pretty and buy new things for their homes. What followed were 20 or arguably even 50 years where women rebelled, which meant that beds went unmade, the sex got better, and the divorce rates went through the roof. So, what we'll talk about today is The Feminine Mystique still relevant, or should we treat it as a historical document that played its role and is no longer relevant? Okay, for those of you who haven't read this book since graduate school, you're going to have to indulge me here a little bit. I'm going to read you the first paragraph because it really is iconic. I've read this book several times, as you can tell. I'm showing the audience my copy, which is not in good shape. But I have read it in bits and pieces over the years. And here is how she starts it. The problem lay buried, unspoken, for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material.
I do that all the time.
Matched slipper for material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night. She was afraid to ask even of herself the silent question, is this all? That's a great beginning to a book. Okay, Noreen, you go first. Does that resonate with you at all? Is this a question you could ever imagine yourself asking when you wake up in the morning and match your slip covers? Is this all?
I know people who match their slip covers in Brooklyn.
What is a slip cover? Is that the thing
it's what you put
pillow?
On your sofa. It's what you put on your sofa, you know, so you don't have to buy a whole new sofa. You can just revamp it. But the reason I know that is because so many people my age are obsessed with decoration, right? And they're obsessed with sort of the things that in Betty Friedan's age were called homemaking that now have become very trendy. And so when I read this, it did feel like a historical document to me. I read it for the first time at age 28 this winter break. I don't really have a winter break anymore, but it felt like college.
Evidence of how young you are that the word winter break is alive in your mind. Like, here's the thing I don't understand. Like, why does Beyonce, like, the fact that Beyonce calls her tour the Mrs. Carter tour, right? Is the homemaking and, like, the Mrs. Carter tour, is that ironic when people are doing that? Or is that, like, are people just sampling, like, the fact that in Brooklyn, only a woman who lives in Brooklyn who has a job would also knit? Or, like, if you're home with your children, then you would never knit, because that would be too actual homemaking as opposed to ironic Brooklyn. No,
I don't. It's a shame we brought Brooklyn in so quickly. I just happen to live there. I don't think that all of this homemaking stuff is as ironic as people say it is. I really think that people are feeling... So we should step back and talk a little bit about The Feminine Mystique. The central thesis of it is that you can't be fully... engaged if you are just at home, if you don't have work outside of the home, right? And I think for many women, myself included, we grew up with never having the idea that you would ever want to stay home. That her book was so successful, and all the other things that came after the book were so successful, that I was able to approach it as a thoroughly historical document and to say, oh, well, I understand why some of my friends aren't fulfilled at work and why they want to knit and why they want to make slipcovers. You know, there is now room for a middle ground, which maybe there wasn't when she was writing. But I, you know,
they actually make the slipcovers, or they just buy them?
I'm going to get you a catalog, Hannah, and you can pick slipcovers.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it. Okay, so Emily, do you approach this as just a historical document? Is there, like, do you remember a time when
I approach this as a historical personage portrayed in the book, because she's describing these small children who she said, you know, it was interesting to read. And something's wrong with the children, too. They seem totally passive, blobby, dumb. And I was like, that's us. I was, you know, one of the
children. Were you a passive
children.
Blob?
No, because now I'm thinking, we're saying all our kids are just sitting there going like this. So the more things change. However,
she was typing. They can't see you on the radio. Emily was fake typing.
Okay.
Yeah.
I grew up as this revolution was happening. I mean, I remember as a little girl talking to my grandmother saying, oh, I want to be an architect like Pop. And she said, well, women shouldn't take jobs away from men. I mean, that's the world I grew up in. I experienced that. And I remember, you know, at holidays, the men would all be sitting around laughing. They were hilarious. And the mothers and my aunts and mother, they're all scrubbing and doing dishes. And they were pretty. And really, I was like, I don't want any of that. I want this, what the guys are doing. So,
And you knew that before you read The Feminine Mystique. You just knew that.
Well, I was one of those little blobby kids that she describes. Yes. So I remember actually seeing Betty Friedan on the Mike Douglas show when the book first came out, and I was quite young, and he was, you know, I mean, there was a little mocking tone, and I remember thinking, ooh, she's right, there's a way out. I don't have to end up in the kitchen.
Well, and the book was not well received after I read it and wrote an angry piece on Slate. Not angry. To lay my cards on the table, I felt like it was judgmental, right? Because I was reading it coming from this place where every choice that a woman makes about whether to work or whether to not work has a lot of bile coming behind it on the internet. And so I've just been so conditioned to think of all discussions about work and motherhood as a war, really, that I was like, well, you're really leading the charge for one side, and you're not. So I felt as if I had to defend the other side.
Well, that's the way in which it's still incredibly contemporary.
Right.
Like, the thing that seems really narrow about this book to me is the emphasis on housework, because that just doesn't seem like such a big issue. Yeah. I mean, I remember, like, Germaine Greer, and, like, when you see her on the stage and she's always talking about, like, I'm going to throw this broom and then take off my shirt and show you my bra, like, somehow sexiness and the broom were total polar opposites. And
Raunchiest podcast.
But you know what I mean? Like, there was something about rejecting housework which was so central to what they needed to do, and housework is just not like a big part of my fight to be a woman.
Are we all
now,
dirtier?
Other
now?
Things are like do, other things are. You
do
know?
We just not clean our houses as much? Or I mean, this is actually something that she writes about. That you know, companies that were manufacturing new dishwashers and new mops needed to sell to women, and they needed to create needs for them, and that was something that you know. So manufacturers now are not telling us that we all need to mop incessantly. We've got one Swiffer and that's it. But now, you know, you're told that you need to use 3 different products on your eyelashes and then 4 different products on your hair. So it's sort of moved, you know, that stuff felt very contemporary to
me.
Yeah,
it's like moved location. Like mm-hmm. Now it's not about the housework, it's about the children. And she does talk about the children, but she talks a hell of a lot about, you know, making a bed and, mm-hmm. and sort of cleaning up and that kind of stuff, which Caitlin Flanagan took this one up. What have we done with that? We've just hired other people to do it. So we sort of, you know, put that one aside, and now the wars have moved to, you know, what is my identity? Am I a mother? Is it okay to be a mother? It's largely around the children and not.
And I'm glad you brought up the Caitlin Flanagan, because we should say that the we here for Betty Friedan, and she's come under some criticism for it. The We Here was definitely upper middle class to wealthy, educated women, a lot of whom had gone to, you know, the Seven Sisters, and a lot of the same fight that we're talking about now is often critiqued for being, you know, a problem of privilege, right? If you're someone who can hire the household help to enable your career, you know, you're coming from a pretty good
place.
That
was in the book, but you have to give her credit for founding NOW, the National Organization for Women, which brought a lot of lawsuits that changed laws for all women. I mean, women used to be able to be, you could be fired if you got pregnant, if you were a teacher or a flight attendant, you couldn't get credit in your own name. So those, part of that revolution that she helped bring about encompassed all women.
And I don't want to seem like I'm belittling her achievement. I actually think it's a testament to how much she did accomplish that I was so taken aback by how long ago this 50 years seemed, right? Like if I had recognized every single part of this book as completely contemporary, that would have been awful. And she, you know, it would have been as if the last 50 years never happened. But the one thing that really struck me, near the end of the book, she has sort of a prescription for how women can make this work, right? They can take on freelance work instead of doing a demanding staff job, or, you know, they can plan out to leave their careers before they actually leave it, which is now exactly what you're told not to do if you want to be a feminist, right? Like, you're not supposed to take the freelance job. Like, the really strong feminist stance is to keep going, to just barrel through it, which I thought was interesting how much that conversation has shifted forward too.
Yeah, although she's really into work as the answer to everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's basically telling everyone to go to work. Like, you will be liberated, go to work, and the liberation will come. And that's not what happened. Like, the liberation didn't come. Like, the identity crisis just moved to a new location. So it's now, like, we wonder, like, should we work part-time or full-time or mother or whatever? No, you think this is...
I disagree with that, because now you have the luxury of making those decisions. And I disagree with both of you.
Good.
I don't think the feminist stance is you have your kids, you go back to work and work the 40, 60, 80-hour weeks. I don't think anyone blinks if you say, I'm going to take X amount of time off or I'll see. I mean, I think we have more of a notion that life is long and more flexible. But back, she was describing a very specific time in which there was nothing else. That's why the housework thing, you had nothing else except making your house sparkle and making your children sparkle. As she says, there's some statistic in the book from the 30s or whatever, people who went to college, almost 50% were women in those days. By the late 50s, it had dropped to 35%. I mean, there was an effort. You don't need that education. It's just going to make you unhappy and put you in a tizzy. So the moment she's describing needed to be blown up.
Sure. Maybe that's the distinction, is that she's describing a moment in which women didn't have any choices or very few choices about what it meant to be a woman in the public space, and we have too many choices. So, like, Beyoncé calls herself Mrs. Carter because she can. She's sampling, right? Mm-hmm. She's not actually being Mrs. Carter. She's, like, the most, as you have also written, like, the most, she's, like, the icon of modern independent, you know, womanhood, right?
And that's and the song, so she independent can. Woman.
Yeah, there you go. Independent world. Woman and girls rule the world, etc., yeah. etc. So she can call herself Mrs. Carter, and it's not a big sacrifice for her because she has everything else. So it's like you can pick and choose to do a little housewifery and do a little this and do a little that, and it's not that threatening.
You can't always, though, because as you have written, women in many households are the ones actually paying the bills, and many people, you know, regardless of gender, are not able to support a family on a single salary, and that up and down the socioeconomic ladder is more the case now. So, in fact, the you know, the terrible economy has sort of solved the problem, you know, in a way, I suppose.
Okay, two more, the unfinished business of the feminine mystique that I want to discuss before we move on. One is it true we have not really separated domesticity from femininity, right? Like, we don't, just because we don't make our houses sparkle, it's still largely considered the woman's realm. Like, I write about this in my book, the idea, even when women are making a ton of money and they're clearly the breadwinners in their house, they almost always keep control of the domestic sphere. Mm-hmm. Even when their husband is a stay-at-home dad, they keep control of the domestic sphere. And we're just in the very, very, very beginnings. I'm talking to myself here. We're just in the very beginnings of men, like portraying men in TV shows and everything, like Guys with Kids or What to Expect When You're Expecting or whatever, or Up All Night, where men are in domestic roles. Like, we're just at the very beginnings of accepting that a guy can strap on the baby Bjorn and not be a wimp, right?
Yeah.
Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Like, we still... Women do domestic stuff.
And we all mock the, like, New York Times trend pieces about, you know, artisanal picklers in Brooklyn and all the men with their beards. But you know, they are men moving into the domestic sphere, and that will seep into the culture, and that's not a bad thing.
That's like just in the super macho way of like Chef Anthony Bourdain can cook ass into the basement. Like, I'm so...
Why can't domesticity be macho? Now you're the one feminizing it.
I don't know. It's just like whenever men... Like, I was reading that article today in the New York Times about those packaged meals. Like,
oh, yeah.
These guys who are, they prepackage a recipe and they send it to you, and like they were all dude entrepreneurs prepackaging recipes, giving quotes about how this is going to help mom's life. And I'm like, mom... is not going to cook Moroccan tagine on Tuesday night for dinner, right? It's not really going to help mom's life. You can package me some chicken soup or something that the children will actually eat, but, you know.
Yeah. Totally.
All right, the last unfinished business.
And then feminine mystique is all
then
set.
Then feminine mystique is all
set. Women's problems are all solved.
So Stephanie Kuntz, who's an academic, wrote a book about the influence of the feminine mystique recently, said that her students, the chapter that seems most relevant to her young students is the sexual cell. And that chapter is about how, you know, the conspiracy of sort of advertising in women's magazines to make you think, you meaning women, think you need a whole bunch of stuff. Like, you need it to be cute, you need it to sort of be a proper woman. Like, what do you think about that? Like, has that changed at all?
No.
But isn't that true about everyone? I watch the Super Bowl with my husband, so almost all the ads are aimed at men. And they had, what was it, the Calvin Klein underwear ad? I mean, if you're, you know, a man with any sort of feeling of body discomfort, that wasn't going to make you feel good about yourself.
Did John, what did he do? Did he, like, look in his...
No, I said you didn't give permission for them to use your body, dear. So. I'm sure many wives were saying that when that ad came on. So it was just consumerism to men. I mean, it's a consumer society, and sure, she's describing something that continues to exist,
But I mean, women's magazines have hot women on the covers, and men's magazines have hot women on the mm-hmm. covers. They don't have, like, hot men who you're supposed to look like. I mean, I know there's still a lot of, you know...
But Playgirl magazine failed. I mean, it was popular in the gay community, but women didn't buy a magazine that had... It had male... When I was in college, it was an attempt to say, okay, we're going to have male centerfolds. It folded.
Mm-hmm. So I subscribe to GQ. That's the only men's magazine I've subscribed to, so I don't have a huge sample. But I think men's magazines are actually more aggressive about their consumerism, right? They have up front a lot of things that you should buy, but they don't have as much about how to perfect yourself, right? And if you look through any women's magazine, you know, up and down the chain, whether it's like Women's Health or Vogue or Double X, but we'll leave it at any glossy women's magazine, I think being told that here are ways that you can perfect yourself and having that next to products is more powerful than having a list of products, right? And that's sort of what she's talking about in the sexual cell. She's saying, here's how you are a better woman. It's by, you know, having a better house and being a better wife. Oh, and by the way, like here are some things that our advertisers have for you to try out. And that, to me, might be the key distinction.
Yeah, although it's getting less of a distinction. I mean, definitely you're right. Like, men are supposed to shave.
Yeah, they're supposed to have no hair.
Right.
I mean, that's like a full-time job for a lot of men.
Does your husband have no hair?
I'm trying to keep the hair off his shoulders and ears. That's
that's as far as you can get. Noreen, I'm sorry to get personal. Have you dated any, like, are men allowed to be hairy when they're dating?
Yeah, I would be weirded out, honestly, if a guy had waxed everything.
What about trimmed?
Trimmed.
Is that a requirement? I'm genuinely curious. I haven't dated in a long time. Like, if you're a guy on the dating market, do you have to groom your... Because that certainly was not the standard when I was dating.
Are you talking landing strip or what?
Not like the 40-year-old virgin. Like, not all wax. Just, does it have to be taken care of, or can it just be let to go free?
I think it can be let to go free. I think it can be let to go free. Guys, you have my number.
Yeah. For the three guys in Brooklyn who let not just their beards but everything else go free, you can call Noreen. Okay. Let's move on to our second topic, which is why do some kids and grown-ups crumble under pressure and others thrive? But before we do, I have to do our ad for our loyal sponsor, Audible.com. Audible.com is the place to go to find practically any cool thing you would want to listen to on the internet, especially books. You can choose from more than 100,000 audiobooks, listen to them on practically any device, including the one you're listening to us on right now. For XX listeners who aren't Audible members already, there is a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at the special URL, which is audiblepodcast.com/XX. Now, the book I'm going to recommend today is obviously The Feminine Mystique, but why am I going to recommend this book? Because the Audible version is read by Parker Posey. It's really funny to listen to in her sort of like flat, annoyed voice. It's just really, really good. Like, she doesn't quite channel this kind of like rage and conspiratorial anger of Betty Friedan, because there's such an edge of irony to it, but it's really a pleasure to listen to her read The Feminine Mystique.
What an amazing pairing.
It's really good. Wow. I know. It was really good choice. Okay. Let's move to our second topic, which is kids and pressure. We seem to be moving to a new understanding of stress and why it can be good for us, but it turns out it's only good for some of us who have a particular form of a certain gene. These lucky ones, who are known as warriors, thrive under pressure, acing tests even if they've only been B students and haven't studied very much. The unlucky ones, who are called the worriers, get overwhelmed by stress and freeze and stare into a future of toil in a hot, noisy, ununionized plant. I made that up. That's not part of the scientific study. In an era of ubiquitous standardized testing, understanding how kids react to tests and how seriously we should take the results is ever more important. So the question we'll talk about today is, have we come upon a critical new human classification, or is this merely another attempt at using fancy biological terms to quantify messy human realities? Emily, I know you have personal experience here.
Well,
Share it with us.
I was a little annoyed with you, Hannah, for assigning us this article. It was an article in last week's New York Times Sunday Magazine. And I was reading it on the Metro, and it was talking about kids and this high-stakes testing. My daughter is taking the SAT in 3 weeks, and this article was giving me heart palpitations. And, I mean, I'm in this thing. I literally, every night at 3 o'clock, I wake up. Does she know what paucity means? I've got to tell her what paucity means. So it actually, the message was kind of helpful.
So what did you tell her? Did you tell her whether she was a warrior or a worrier? Or
are you a warrior?
Let me just say, I have a 17-year-old. So for me to most effectively give her advice on what to do with the SAT, I would say, get no sleep the night before, go on an empty stomach, and look around and say, everyone else here is smarter than me. Because if I actually gave her the opposite, she'd be really pissed off.
Right.
So the article actually was kind of helpful in that there's no way to avoid stress and pressure and tests and deadlines. And, you know, instead of thinking of it as an awful thing to be avoided, you know, it's a challenge to rise to. And it did talk about that there are some people for whom, you know, think Navy SEALs or whatever, they want this high stress, high adrenaline experience. So I thought it was helpful for all of us to recast it and say this isn't an awful thing. I mean, I became a journalist, so there'd be this outside pressure to actually do it.
But how do you know which one you are? Like, what if you're one of these people who is the worrier, and then suddenly you're told you should be in a high-stress situation, and you're just screwed?
Well, one of the secrets in the article is that it said 50% of people... Now, first of all, you have to accept that this is right. 50% of people are a little of both.
Right.
And only 25% are one of each, but then it can be modified. I'm not sure I buy this new taxonomy. What do you think?
Do either of you feel like clearly a warrior or a worrier?
No, I'm more one than the other. But I,
which one?
I'm more a warrior than a worrier. Like, I also wanted the deadlines, which are, I write everything up to the last minute. I need that. I can't write without it. And I kind of love taking tests, right? So I guess that means I'm a warrior. Should have been a Navy SEAL, I guess. But I came out of the article sort of wishing that I were a worrier because, in fact, the higher your level of training, right, the more to your advantage it is to be a worrier, right? So warriors can take something that's thrown to them, but warriors train for something, and they think about something, and they plan ahead, and they end up ahead, right?
Warriors are smarter. They're
right,
just
right.
Worse. If you're a pure worrier, you apparently have a higher IQ,
yeah,
but you're just no good at taking tests. Do you guys want the dopamine explanation? Just clap if you want the dopamine explanation.
You put them on the spot.
I put them on the spot, but it's like it's really hard to understand what the hell this study is talking about. But the science is actually a little difficult, so I'm going to give this a try here. I actually wrote it down. If you understand what I'm saying, you can clap at the end, and if you don't, just actually don't clap. So, okay, the gene is called the COMT gene, which is the COMT gene, and it regulates dopamine in the brain. So the one variant of the gene rapidly clears dopamine, and another does it slowly. And the people with the slow-acting version are the worriers. They have higher IQs, they can problem-solve methodically, and they can plan really well. But under stress, they don't clear the dopamine quickly enough, so they get overwhelmed like a car being flooded with too much gasoline. That makes sense? Yes, okay. The worriers are slow and lackadaisical. Real life does not do it for them. It doesn't provide enough stimulation from them. But if you put them in a test room or a crisis, they become like, as one researcher said, Superman emerging from the phone booth. Okay, so how many people in this room have a clear sense that they are a warrior? Clap if you think you're a warrior. So the warrior is the Superman, yeah.
Wait,
Superman emerging from a booth.
Right.
Warrior is like lazy, 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 and then fires, right? Okay, how many of you think you're a worrier, which means you're smart, organized, but you might choke on a test?
It's about equal.
Okay, but then how many feel, okay, I'm a little bit of a mixture?
I'm a mixture.
I think I'm
a mixture. Yeah. But it says most of us are. That's why now we've unraveled the mystery of this. I don't quite buy it. There was an anecdote in the story saying that some of the researchers in this told people first in kind of a lab experiment they were going to be taking a standardized test that feeling anxious about this is actually really good for you.
Yes, they said the phrase they told people, I wrote it down, it's really good. You can tell this to your daughter. Research suggests, Ellie dear, that people who might feel anxious during a test do better. Isn't that interesting, Ellie dear?
Can you tell her that?
I will tell her that.
Okay.
I'll send her an email, yes. So people who read that statement, what happened to them?
Their score went up 50 points. And then these people were actually taking the graduate record exam, and the researchers say the effect persisted, and on average, the people who were told that sentence scored 65 more points. And I would really like to see the study and see the guts of the study, because I am a little dubious that a single sentence as an incantation has that much of an effect. And if so, what did I pay for all this tutoring
right.
for?
For me, the problem with that part of the story was that this always happens in stories that are about like biological determinism, is you spend 5,000 words of a story reading about how we have discovered this new gene, and this new gene tells you exactly how you're going to react on a test, and then they always do one of these sort of they just said one sentence, and then the whole thing turns out to be bullshit. Like, you can solve this, you can override the gene by putting one sentence on top. So then why do we need to know about the genetic determinism if all you need to do to fix
just
the problem?
Read
that sentence, and then it's done, right? So it seems kind of pointless. But it is actually having policy implications. Like in Taiwan, you know, in these, and there are, you know, Asian testing cultures. I write about Korea in my book, where everything is basically determined by test, what school you go to, whether you get tracked into vocational education. It's like really serious business, even more than the SAT, how meaningful these tests are. I forgot what they're called, but they're the tests that sort of track you vocational or educational. They've stopped giving them. All of this research comes out of Taiwan, and they stopped giving these tests because they felt like they were disadvantaging unnecessarily the worriers, that they were taking these people who were actually higher IQ, excellent planners, and that these people were doing really badly on these tests, and then they would end up with all of their methodical planning and high IQ thoughts toiling in the non-unionized plants,
which
making
is
small parts for my iPhone. So,
well, so Hannah, I hear that there's also a movement in Washington, D.C. against testing. Is that true?
Oh, yes. I have a daughter who is like really against testing. And she actually sent me her essay, and I don't know that she'll be happy or not happy if I read it. She wrote a short story, which is her high testing protest. Should I read it or not? Is that indulging? Clap if you want me to read the story. Okay. I had her email it to me. I'll read a shortened version of it, but it's called The Little Data Point and the Big Bad Test. Once upon a time, there was a little data
point. Say how old your daughter
is. She's 12. Once upon a time, they were given the test last week, and she refused to fill out the bullet points, and she just wrote a protest letter. I have to say, this makes me really happy, because I have gone all these years thinking she was so good and obedient, and that was a bad thing for a girl to be so good and obedient. So if she's going to choose as her sort of brainiac form of protest, you know, to sort of not fill out the bubbles in the test, I'm for it. I can't read this whole thing. This is like ridiculously indulgent. I'll read it really quickly. Once upon a time, there was a little data point named Rosenplatz Noah. Her friends call her by her ID, number 9 blank blank, or 9 for short. She liked her job most of the time, but 6 times a year, or 19 days in total, came the big bad test. The little data point completed the test dutifully each time, mulling the possibilities of Paul Revere's horse's emotions and checking her work not once but twice. She and the other data points together formed a chart, which was their job. The little data point felt very proud at having been part of such a great endeavor, and then one day she felt a different emotion. The little data point felt angry. The little data point thought, is this all I am good for, providing data on tests? This sounds like Betty Friedan. Is this all there is to life? These questions are dumb, thought the little data point. I should not spend my life answering them. Paul Revere's horse will never change the world. Paul Revere's horse is dead. But I can still change the world, and I will never do that by answering these questions day after day, year after year. And that little data point did not answer her questions. By the way, she got in trouble for doing this. The little data point ripped up her test and threw it in the deep, dark recesses of the trash to fester and eventually die a slow and painful death lasting for all of eternity. That's a good essay.
It's a good essay.
Yeah. Okay, so should we end standardized testing then, based on this, Gene? I think we would say no.
Well, yeah, what's the alternative? I genuinely would like there to be an alternative, but I don't know what it is.
Well, I do think it's a good thing not to have one test that determines your life. I mean, these poor kids good that Taiwan stopped that. What if you don't feel well on that day? That's the rest of your life? That's insane.
I agree.
Totally against all testing. But testing as the sole determinant is ridiculous.
You know, maybe what happened was that there was this sort of cultural discontent with the testing, but they needed like a solid genetic excuse to stop the testing. And so, you know, these group of research, they came upon something concrete, and that was good, and now they won't have the testing anymore, you know? So maybe that's a good thing. And then my last question on this, what do you guys make of this kind of broader business of like a gene is discovered, a personality trait is identified? You feel like I do about this, right? It's like, this is going to be our future. This is going to happen once every 3 months. We're going to come upon a new human classification, warrior versus warrior, and it's going to be like this genetic, you know, genetically determined thing, and then we're going to realize that we jumped.
Doesn't
too
it give
far.
You an identity crisis every time, though?
Yes.
I kind of always read these, and I'm like, oh, maybe I should have turned left that one time, because
right.
I've only, you know, if I'd known I was a warrior, it would have all been different, you know,
right.
Navy SEALs.
You would have done the Navy SEALs.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's why they're so compelling, right? Because they have, they invite you to self-reflection in a really judgmental way.
Right. It's like our modern version of the color wheel. Like, am I a winter person?
Yes.
Like, now we just have sophisticated neurological color wheels. Okay. Well, We're going to move on to topic three, but we need the questions. People in the audience filled out questions on note cards. They're completely anonymous, although it seems some people signed them.
I'll read your name.
And everyone knows the history of Dear Prudence, right?
Yes, how I'm going to talk about that, but okay. I want to give Emily 1 second to read those. Well, I'll give the introduction anyway. Yeah. So, loyal Slate readers in the audience, you will know Emily Yaffe as Dear Prudence, the advice columnist extraordinaire. To those of us in Slate, we know Emily as the person who constantly hogs the most read list. It's very hard to get your story higher than a Dear Prudy story. You cheer very loud if your story jumps over Dear Prudy, and that rarely happens. Any given day, you will see a Dear Prudy headline such as, "Is my engagement ring too small?" Or the classic, "My wife is pregnant by another man's baby." Or, "At what point should I tell my boyfriend I'm wearing a wig?" These are all real questions. The thing that I personally love about Dear Prudy is that she has a very strong backbone and also a very deep soul, that she's able to be stern with people who deserve it, but always very caring. Also, that she's widely trusted by people who find themselves in really seriously freaky situations. They always find Emily, like, "My brother and I kiss and cuddle. Is that okay?" No.
See how easy it is,
huh? And they write to you like you're so understanding. I actually recently read that letter, and it was just like, "Well, you know, we haven't had sex yet." And I was like, "What? Oh, great, you haven't had sex yet. That's good."
Because... Well, but I was understanding of the gay twins who'd been in an incestuous relationship for most of their lives. So maybe that's
why. Because it's hard to find a gay partner these days, so you gotta...
That's a whole other letter.
Okay, so before we get to the questions, I want to interview, because I'm very curious, Emily in her persona as Dear Prudy on the love questions. Is there a recurring theme that comes up in love questions? Like, do you get the same questions 35,000 times? Like, is there just some regulars among the love category?
Yes, and I put together kind of a just very random list of things that I've drawn from being Dear Prudence over the years. So let me
just... Yes, okay, do your list. Okay, yes.
If you have a fetish, you need to disclose this really early in the relationship. Other people don't make you act a certain way. If you don't like who you're becoming because of your relationship, get out. Don't punish your current partner for the misdeeds of your last one.
That's good.
This might get me in trouble, and not here, I'm sure. Don't marry a virgin. What is that about? That's that's just ridiculous.
What if you're like 24 or 23? Like at any
do
age?
Do it so first. Do it together.
Oh, I see.
You know,
do it together.
First.
And then, yeah.
Do
okay,
it
so first. That when you're getting married,
yeah, right.
You're not a virgin.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't move in without some kind of clear goal and plan, discussing where this is going to go, so then you're not in the, "Do I give him an ultimatum?" Okay.
That's unpopular, I think.
My advice there?
I think the move-in advice is unpopular.
Well, yeah, but then I hear from these, it's been 3 years, and he keeps saying he doesn't want to talk about it right now. I mean, unfortunately, it's almost always women in that. There's no nice person inside the abuser. He's just an abuser, or she. Porn is not cheating, neither is masturbation, but a porn obsession is not good. And
masturbation, people think of as cheating?
I walked in and my husband was masturbating, and I thought everything was so good.
So it's like he cheated on me with his penis.
Yeah. You, well, with his hand, yeah.
His hand, sorry, that's...
Yeah.
You really get the gamut of people writing in. From
and,
the twins to the...
Yeah. And here's the last one, and it occurred to me after watching the most recent episode of Girls that we could all do well by being a little more Lena Dunham in our nudity. Just hey, let it hang out there, because I get a lot of letters, "My thighs aren't good," or the, you know...
Which being, body part is not good the most? Is it
being
thighs?
Just confident about your sexuality and attractiveness is a turn on to guys, as we saw in that most recent episode.
Right. Okay.
So, did I answer all your questions?
I'm trying not to get into girls.
No, I don't want to.
I always call you out.
I always get in trouble for mentioning girls too much. So it wasn't me. It was Emily who did it.
No,
I'm not even allowed to ask whether people were pro the last episode or not.
I was so passive aggressive. Did you guys like the last episode?
Yes. Excellent.
I think we all did too.
Who hated it? Who thought it was the worst episode ever? Oh.
Let's see.
All right. I think we won. Okay, so let's go to the questions. Go ahead. Did you choose any? Did you have time?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Dear Prudence, I am completely in love with my business school professor. Today is Valentine's Day, and my mom suggested that I buy him an expensive box of chocolates. I say she's nuts. What do you think? How cute is this professor? Mom is nuts. I mean, obviously. And don't buy him nut chocolates. I mean, the guy's your professor. He's a professor. This is back in the Betty Friedan era, you could have done this. And, you know, you two could have gone off and get
married.
So
why is it wrong now? What if the person is, I mean, we don't have a lot of information.
Wait,
but
what
let's
if
say,
they're 35 and 40?
Yeah.
Like it's a...
He's the professor. He can...
Second semester of the last year.
Finish the class, get your grade, and then after it's all done, the grade's filed, everything, then it's fine to get in touch and say, look, I love the class. Could you get a cup of coffee?
I love the class.
Yes. Could you get a cup
advice.
Of... No. Could you get a cup of coffee
one?
Sometime? And then he can... that you have. You don't want to just... plunge into this, I want to shift this to romantic, then he can, I don't socialize with my students, or you've got to be a little delicate. Now, I have to, this advice from mom reminded me of some advice I got from my mother. In fifth grade, I was obsessively in love with Jeff Walensky, and I would stand in front of his house and just hope... He would pass by, and I was up at a stationery store, and I saw, this is radio. I saw a card. It was about a foot. It was a foot-high card that you opened, and it opened to 2 feet. And the front said, I love you, and you open it, and it's a figure with arms out this much. So I said to my mother and grandmother after I'd seen it, should I go back and buy that card and send it to Jeff? And they said yes.
Oh, no.
And I've had a troubled relationship with my mother, so maybe, Okay, they said yes. I did it. I delivered it.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. I hope he's listening now.
The next day at school, he brought the card in, showed everyone, and then proceeded to turn it into 1,000 spitballs, which he spit at me.
That's
okay,
so wrong.
So this might affect my, reaction to the Valentine's candy. Okay.
If you give advice,
you can't completely break away from your own personal experience.
Fifth grade guys are not noted for their maturity, you know.
What would Jeff do now? He would put it on his. Google
he would say thank you.
No, he would not say thank you.
He would say thank you, and then he'd talk behind your back about how you're crazy.
Jeff's not getting any more cards from me.
Have you ever, you haven't looked him up on Facebook or anything?
We actually...
Because I'm going to do that today.
Actually, I was back home. I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts. About 10 years ago, I was back home for some family thing. We were out in a restaurant, and there was Jeff. Across the room.
Wait, how many years ago?
About 10 years ago. Uh-huh. Yeah, I immediately recognized him.
Did you talk?
You, like drop
I,
your? Water,
I
you,
went
like,
over.
Your water.
I said to my husband, "I'll be back in a couple of days."
Dear Prudy, I ran into my old.
No, no, friend. It was. He was there with his girlfriend, who he was living with an older woman. She was 10 or 15 years older than he, and. And so we started talking, and she actually came sort of in between us. Nice to meet you. And so they broke up. I did see on Facebook they broke up.
Not that you followed
I'm not,
closely.
No, I'm not looking at all. Okay, here's another one. How do I convince my boyfriend that I don't want an engagement ring, especially one that is completely overpriced and worth the down payment of a house? This is a very unusual variation of the letter I usually get, which is from a desperate guy who's literally rethinking the whole relationship because he says, we're, you know, just getting out of graduate school. I love her. I want to get married. I have no money. And now she's talking about cut color and clarity and rock size and what is going on. I love this because how do you convince him except say, let's make a down payment on a house. I don't want this rock.
Why does a man want to buy a $10,000 engagement? No, I mean, really, what does that signifies? We need to hear from some of the men in the question and answer, but it signifies like, I really, 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 really love you. Is that what it is? It's just like a sign of your extra love for somebody?
It's a show-off-y thing.
Or it's just a
well, you're in
the,
your friends yeah. are now getting rocks. What are...
Well, I'm not into engagement rings. No, I mean, I a lot of my friends can sit there and tell you, they could ballpark figure, tell you how much it costs, where it came from, like what style it is. I have sort of ignored all that, so I don't know. But I know people who don't have engagement rings, and they just, actually Juliette Lapidos, a former Slate staffer, did not want one, and she just said it. And he said, okay. I think, you know, if you really know someone, you know whether they're telling the truth or not about whether they want a ring.
Right. I regret, I mean, I have a diamond ring. My mother actually works for a diamond dealer. If anybody needs a discount on a diamond ring, you can email me, and my mother will provide one for you, which she has done for many, many people. But I don't understand why I cared. Like, I will wear it forever because, you know, it's my wedding ring. But I guess I didn't not care enough to object to it. But first of all, I completely buy into the conspiratorial theory about the diamond industry, that it's totally meaningless. And you would much rather have, like, a gold ring from the grand. I mean, there are meaningful pieces of jewelry that one can give to a fiancé. But a diamond ring is a completely commercially manufactured desire.
But it's a symbol now, right? And if you want a symbol of your love, and it's there, and you're going to sit around at a wedding shower and compare rings with the other girls, you want it, or, you know?
As the radio listeners can't see, I have a plain gold band. And maybe, again, I'm coming out of my own kind of bitter experience, because when I got engaged, my now husband said, you don't want an engagement ring, do you? So,
And what did you say?
I was not quite 39 when I got married, so this whole thing was miraculous, and I was like, no, of course I don't. So,
were you already pregnant?
No. Can you believe that? My grandmother actually said, when I called her, said, it's a miracle. So, but I have gotten so many letters from guys who are really worried. I mean, to me, this whole ring thing, if you can write the check without a sweat and it's mm-hmm. something you want to do and it's fun for the two of you, great. If you are going into debt, you're putting it on a credit card, it's awful. And then there's this other kind of ugly aspect of guys writing in and saying, I've been told how big this should be because, you know, her friends will mock her. If it's not big enough, gets in a whole other. Okay, well, let's move to another. Okay.
Well, and one more thing, which is that now the shot of just the ring has become a thing on Facebook and Instagram, and you will see it, and so that puts an extra spotlight on it because
right. You're not going to do that, Noreen. You're not. I'm not going to let you.
I'm not. Don't worry.
Okay. I haven't read this one all the way through, so I'm just going to plunge in. Dear Prudence, my lesbian partner of 8.5 years left me for my uncle after an extended emotional affair. After almost 2 years, some family members are hoping to forgive and forget and are encouraging me to do the same, but I want nothing to do with them and probably never will. We will all be at a family wedding in April. What do I do?
Oof.
I would say this is the first one I've had like this, but I actually, a few months ago, had a letter from a woman who's, she was married, they were having terrible fertility problems. And the marriage ended when he said, "I got your sister pregnant."
Right.
Oh, my God.
I remember that letter.
And
there was a wedding, too, right?
Oh, there was a big wedding. There was a wedding. He left her, married the sister. They had a kid. And so
the mom was, like, encouraging her to be a good aunt to the child and forgive and forget.
The mother
was—this
was several years later. The family was obviously split apart, and the mother was trying to broker some kind of reconciliation.
So it could be worse, whoever this person
is. Yes. You know, part of this makes me, I mean, I don't want to be insensitive, but your partner, if you're in a lesbian relationship, so your partner has said, "Guess what? I'm heterosexual." I mean, does that make it a little, so your relationship was not going to last anyway, which is kind of one way of, I mean, it doesn't take away that it was done in an awful way and with a family member, but that relationship sounds doomed anyway.
Well, that's a binary view of sexuality, Emily.
Okay. I knew I'd get creamed for that. Okay, but here's, the family wedding. Well, I always think if you want to go to the wedding, you should go. You should not let these other people keep you from enjoying things from it. You know, you have to plot out, are they going to be at whatever, because there will be weddings, there will be funerals, there will be Christmases. So you have to do what's right for you, you know, not stay home and not go if they're not going to go. And I don't think you're in a position to say, well, if they're on the list, I won't go and put the bride and groom in this. I have to decide between people. This is going to go on a long time. I always think the, "Hi, nice to see you. Excuse me, get a drink," goes a long way.
Don't get a drink. I feel like that could end badly.
See, I feel like, you know, that things like grief and betrayal happen at their own rate. And there's, you know, there's often a kind of, you know, push to make it seem abnormal if you've been grieving for too long, or if you've been
yes,
feeling betrayed for too long. But you could, in that situation, you really love that person. It doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman they went to, but you just feel so deeply betrayed that you will just recover at your own schedule. Like, if the wedding happens before your recovery happens, then, well, that's just bad timing. Maybe it'll be 15 years before you can talk to your uncle again, and that's okay.
There's no, you don't have to forgive and forget. But as this letter writer says, it's been 2 years. So just for your own sake, to say, day in, day out, 360 whatever days a year, I don't confront them, deal with them, but I'm going to go to this wedding and have a great time and just stay in opposite sides of the room.
All right, let's do one more because we're going long. We can do some later, but let's do a last one.
Okay, I actually wanted to... I went because, you know, I was looking for some of my greatest romantic hits. So I want to read a letter that's several years old.
Okay.
But to me, it was one of the most amazing letters I've ever gotten.
Did you answer it?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
"Dear Prudence, I've fallen in love with a woman I knew from childhood and ran into again after not seeing her for 20 years. As kids, we had hardly noticed each other, but when we met again after all these years, we felt an immediate attraction. The problem is that when I was 12 years old, I did something terrible that caused an accident that killed her father. No one ever found out it was me, and I've never told anyone after all these years. I feel horrible about what happened, but it was a long time ago, and I've gotten on with my life. But now what? Should I tell this woman I caused her father's death many years ago? I'm afraid it would ruin our relationship." You think? What do you think? "And we love each other a great deal. The accident occurred when I was in a cornfield at night. We were throwing corn at cars when they drove by. We couldn't see the cars because we were hidden in the field. An ear of corn I threw went through the open car window, struck her father in the head, causing him to lose control of the car and crash into a tree. I ran from the scene and was never implicated. Signed, guilty and confused."
Oh, God.
Is that amazing?
That is the worst.
I don't know why this wasn't made into a Lifetime movie. Or
wow.
Is that amazing?
Well,
you will be shocked to hear I said you can't kill your fiancé's father and expect that that's going to be okay.
I really would love for you to follow up with them and figure out what happened. That's an amazing letter.
Yeah.
Because in some sense, the reason he's attracted to her might have to do with that he's been carrying this secret all these years that he killed somebody, and, you know, he needs the secret to be resolved in some way, and so he feels like he's going to do right by the daughter in a weird way by loving her, but then it's all tangled up and insane.
Emily, do you ever follow up?
I haven't contacted people until the end of last year when Slate was we were doing readers edit, and so readers voted on some of their favorite questions from last year to find out what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I love it when people write into me and tell me what happened, but usually they're done with me after they've written the letter. So,
so you just assume they all took your advice and it worked out perfectly.
Right.
But last year I did follow up with people and they were remarkably responsive. So I think, you know, I'll do some of that. But this was a long time ago. So
yeah.
Corn killer, we don't know what happened.
The corn killer is the corn killer, poor guy. Anyway, okay, well, I want to do 200 more, but we have gone on too long, and so we can save some for later if there's appetite. But let's move on to our recommendations, which we always do at the end of the show. Noreen, you go first.
Well, all I've been doing culturally is watching House of Cards. Watched the entire thing in a really short amount of time. But since finishing that, I've begun Vampires in the Lemon Grove, which is Karen Russell's new collection of short stories. And I actually still have not read Swamplandia, but it's wonderful so far. And it's not a type of literature that I usually like. I'm not a big magical realism person, but she's just so good. It's really engaging.
Excellent. That sounds good. I actually have two recommendations. One is, Slate ran an amazing story about something called ASMR. It's a type of YouTube video that is very popular these days. I have a friend in this audience, I'm not going to name who she is, although she knows who she is, who has always done something I found really particular and strange, which is that she listens on the radio for certain voices, and records them, not because the people are saying anything interesting, but because they help put her to sleep. So may she never tell any of those
not
people.
Not this podcast.
Not me. Okay. I'm not one of the voices. May she never tell these people who they are. And I always thought this was really weird and tried to encourage her to write a story about it and see, like, was there something about the tone? Well, it turns out this is like a huge phenomenon of these videos, and they're called Let Me Take Care of You videos, and they are the weirdest things I've ever seen. And so you should all look them up. So they're essentially people, and they're mostly women, speaking in a very soothing voice, close up to the camera, role-playing a dermatologist's assistant or your mom. And I know you're thinking, like, I watch these videos, some of which are like half hour and an hour long, and you keep waiting for the point when, like, the fishnets are coming or like the big boo. Like, you want them to be like a weird sexual fetish, but they are totally not. They're just people speaking in what they call whisper voice. Oh, honey, it's so hard to be sick. Let me dab your forehead.
I think that's a fetish of some kind.
It's kind of a fetish of some kind, but they interview these guys, and it's like it makes them feel relaxed and cozy and warm and taken
sure.
care of. And mostly men watch them, and mostly women do them, and then they fall asleep. Anyway, it's not my thing. They would make me so anxious. I would be like, I really have to do something now. There's got to be something I can get done in this half hour when I'm watching this video. Okay, I have a second recommendation. I almost never do this, but I need the podcast listeners to help me out because there's this new book called The Last Girlfriend on Earth by Simon Rich. I'm showing it right now, and I really can't decide if it's like the dumbest book I've ever read or the most genius book I've ever read. It takes all these ancient myths and it sets them in modern times, and you're going to indulge me. I'm just going to read. I've done so much reading on this podcast. I've never done that before. I'm going to read you a little bit of one story. Her silky eyelashes fluttered as she sang, and whenever she hit a high note, she playfully splashed the water with her feet. She was naked from the waist up, two large breasts protruding from her slender bird-like frame. Brent was trying to figure out what to say to her when she called out his name. "I'm sorry," he said. "Do I know you?" She bashfully turned away, her pale cheeks crimsoning in the moonlight. Now, this woman is a siren. That's the joke. She's a siren. She's one of the sirens, and she kills people. And then he goes on, "Not exactly, but I've been to a couple of your shows. You're in the fuzz, right?" Brent's eyes widened with amazement. His band had only formed a few months ago. No one had even recognized him before. Even when he headlined at Club Trash, he'd had to show his ID at the door. "I can't believe you've heard of me," he admitted. The girl let loose a high-pitched musical laugh. "I haven't just heard of you," she cried. "I worship you." And it goes on this whole thing where she asks him on a date, and his friends say, "Dude, that girl's trouble." Brent scoffed. "What are you talking about?" His roommate Rob turned towards him, muting the TV to emphasize his words important. "She's a fucking siren," he said. "She lures people out to that rock and, like, eats their flesh." Anyway, it goes on like that, and he just does it in the sort of modern, like, there's one about Zeus and his son is a club promoter. If I describe them to you, they sound so stupid, but they're so funny and so cleverly done. But I just can't decide if they're really stupid or really great.
There have been a few in the New Yorker, right? Excerpts? I thought they were funny. I mean, I'm on your team.
You're on
this
the funny
one.
Team.
Yeah.
Okay. Emily, go ahead.
For Valentine's Day, I recommend catching in its... I think it's still in theaters. It's nominated for Best Foreign Film Award, A Royal Affair. It's a Danish movie based on a real historical incident where the wife of a crazy king has an affair with the king's doctor, and many amazing things result. It's a terrific movie. And my other one is A.S. Byatt's Possession, which is a wonderful romance mystery set in 20th century London and 19th century London, two parallel stories, and it's terrific.
Excellent. Well, thank you all for joining us today and coming tonight. I'd like to thank Mike Volo, who's in the back, who's engineering and producing this podcast, Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. Finally, I'd like to encourage everyone who's listening in here to come on our XX Facebook page and recommend things that we should talk about in coming weeks. For Noreen and Emily and all of you at the Six and I audience, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will see you next time. All right, we talked way too much, so we don't actually have that much time for questions, but anybody have any questions that they want to ask of any of us?
Hi. I was curious, when you were talking about the feminine mystique, and I kind of expected this idea of sort of a reversal of those ideas to come up, just the sense of, like, what it's like to be a young woman who is so focused on work.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? Where it's like, if that's the main driver in your life, which I think is the situation for a lot of young women I know, and you sort of don't have that, like, only option that we talked about earlier. I don't know. I was just very curious about thoughts on that.
I think I would say that that's still, a woman would be judged for being that person. Like, that's a way in which the feminine mystique still has a hold on us, that if you're the kind of woman who's made work the only thing in her life, people might give you a hard time about that still, which they might not
give a man.
Yeah. They do, right. So, like, you know, like, we wonder about the Supreme Court justices. Like, why don't they have a family, and why don't they have children, and is that okay? Is that normal? Or when Marissa Mayer became the CEO of Yahoo and decided, I mean, that's not the same. She has a kid, but when she took no maternity leave and sort of went right back to work, I think that women get judged pretty hard for that. So that's the way in which we haven't escaped that, really.
Right. So your advice, I guess, I'm asking.
Advice? That's Emily's thing. I don't really do advice. So if you're a woman, you find yourself in the situation, you know, your work is the main focus of your life and you're happy that way? I mean, is that the implication, that you're not necessarily searching for something else? You just find you're in that position.
Well,
you don't really want to change it?
I'll overshare since this is
not you. You can do you or one.
One. So say you're 29. And your therapist tells you that you're in your prime childbearing years and hopes that you don't regret the choices you're making right now.
Get a new therapist.
Get a new therapist.
Yeah.
Yes. So, you know what I mean? So if it's sort of like, so say you sort of want to take a less harsh version of that into consideration in your life without sacrificing your work.
I think I think it's so personal. I think that's why everyone ends up judging, because everyone compares it against their own experience. I'm sitting here running in my mind like, okay, I'm 28 and you know, I'm I think you have to figure that out for yourself, right?
Yeah, 29 is not...
Yeah, you have so much time.
Yeah, tell my therapist.
I mean, it's fine for a therapist to challenge you, but if you're feeling, you know, the sense of dread, I'm going to go in and get this lecture that I don't want to hear and don't believe, then Noreen is right. You need to change therapists.
Oh, I will. I will.
Are you in love with your therapist?
No. Not. She's like a judgmental grandma. No, it's not working, but thank you very much.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just wondering what you thought about Beyoncé's performance at the Super Bowl. Was it ultra-feminist or anti-feminist?
The what?
Did you? I thought it was ultra-feminist, right?
Beyoncé
performance. The Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Can you explain? You're like our Beyoncé. Yeah. You got Beyoncé down this month. So.
I'm just a really big Beyoncé fan, and the fact that I got to use it in my work life, I'm still just so happy about. What's not feminist about it, right? The fact that she's dancing around in a skimpy costume, what's wrong with that? Like, isn't that the point of whatever wave of feminism we're on, is that you can be respected and do your job and dress how you want, right?
Yeah, but you were complaining about women's magazines. Like, Beyoncé is a role model at some level, right? Like, young girls watch Beyoncé and they think, they'll never grow up to be like Beyoncé, but they might think that they could grow up to be like Beyoncé. And, you know, it's not, I mean, why doesn't it matter at all? I'm with you. You totally convinced me that we should be on Beyoncé's team, but I'm just curious.
Well, celebrities are tough, right? That's like a special case. Anyone who's seriously comparing themselves to a celebrity, that's not good. And that is what women's magazines do, right? You can appreciate someone's performance and think it's really fierce and feminist and awesome and not compare yourself to Beyoncé, because that's a fool's game, right? She also, I think it's important to note that the Super Bowl performance was not an isolated Beyoncé incident. It's sort of like, I think Vulture has started calling it the winter of Beyoncé. Because she's everywhere. You know, she was at the inauguration. She also has this HBO documentary that is produced and directed by her, which is quite a feat.
About her.
About her. And
she's like, Beyoncé, give me more. Okay, I can't give you more, Ned.
But one of the things that she has made an explicit theme of that, and then in interviews she's been doing, she did one with GQ where she talked about this a lot. She's talked about how hard it is for her to maintain this edifice, right? To be the perfect Beyoncé. And it's probably a lot easier for her than for the rest of us. But the fact that she's talking about the pressure to be perfect, I think is important, right? Because she is one of the people who's helping create that air of perfectness that we're all striving for.
Did she ever talk about her child?
You know, not that much, which I think that's to her credit, to be honest. Like, that baby is so famous that, you know, any bit of information, who knows what would happen.
Right. Okay. Anyone else? Yes, sir. Come.
I'm also going to go back to the Betty Friedan profile. You guys basically endorsed choice feminism, and I found interesting that you discussed the decision to work versus stay at home in terms of personal fulfillment, but there wasn't any discussion of economic dependence. I mean, that would have obviously been a critical issue at that time of people being trapped into marriage just because they literally wouldn't be able to support themselves, but I mean, it's still an issue now. I mean, if you were to stay home and then look after children for 20 years, I mean, precisely what sort of career could you possibly have afterwards if you had to be self-sufficient? And I wondered why that wasn't part of the discussion.
Yeah, it was interesting to me. It wasn't that big a part of the discussion because it's not a big part of Betty Friedan's ideas, which I find, I didn't understand why, right? So she talks about, the book is written, I don't know if you've read it in a long time, but it's like a broad cultural conspiracy. So she doesn't really get that, you know, it's like housework and then really, really broad. So it's a lot of personal testimonies from women. But the idea of work is this very sort of distant idea. She doesn't connect all the dots and say, you know, in order for you not to be in this situation, you're going to have to earn money. In order to earn money, you're going to need a job. You know, she doesn't walk you through all that. I'm not sure if it's because it seemed very distant, and economic dependence in the 1950s, it wasn't true in earlier eras. Like, I mean, what she's describing is a pretty particular era, right? In the 20s and 30s, I think women did think a lot about economic independence, and there was a flood of women entering the workforce, particularly in the working and middle class, in earlier decades. But then all of a sudden, the idea of dependence on the breadwinner male was just like, you didn't even question it. It was just like the air and the sun and the sky, right? It was just like part of what it meant to be a woman. So she doesn't even like raise it to the surface. It was really interesting reading it.
She does, though. She does write about the lack of experience re-entering the job market. And she says, you know, these women have these wonderful degrees. And again, she is talking about a privileged subset of women. But she does say, you know, it's going to be very difficult for them, even with this wonderful degree in rocket science or whatever, to then go back and re-enter the job market.
But she does talk about jobs as a source of satisfaction,
yes,
not jobs as a source of economic independence.
Right. She talks
well,
about...
Well, careers.
Careers, that vague
careers.
Word. Like, you're a career girl.
Right, that's right. A good
distinction. But she's saying it's not just a job, something you do. You should... She wants people to think in terms of careers. She wants women to go to college and really engage with something and find out what interests them.
Mm-hmm. And she is a little dismissive of women who do have jobs to help pay the bills. Those are sort of not who she's talking to.
Yeah, the dilemma she describes would not apply to many, many, many women. It's a particular dilemma that's caused by going to college, thinking of yourself as a bright star and preparing yourself, and then suddenly being stuck at home. If you were the kind of woman who knew all your life that you were going to work all your life, then this doesn't really make any sense to you. You haven't been duped by anything. You just knew you were going to work. Yes.
Hi. I actually wasn't even going to stand up, but then the young woman brought up an issue that I think a lot of us are grappling with. Full disclosure, I'm 32, so I hear you. I think for me, I'm probably over the hill. I have a lot of people telling me to freeze my eggs. And the question, you know, to kind of bring the gentleman's question a little bit forward is, as we're talking about working and, you know, parenting and all that stuff, we talk a lot about, you know, Marissa Mayer going back to work 2 weeks after she had her baby as though it was a choice. Except that it wasn't really a choice, because she's the CEO of a company, she's very visible, and if she had taken off more time, it would have been considered a liability. So, you know, I have friends who are pregnant and are being asked to not take their 3 months of maternity leave, but come back after 2 months. They're being asked, right? Air quotes. But it's not really an issue of choice. And yesterday in the State of the Union, President Obama was talking about universal preschool, which seemed like a great idea to, you know, get more education to, you know, to people as early as possible. But one thing we haven't really discussed is universal maternity leave, right? As women have become, you know, equal breadwinners in the house, we're not valuing their, you know, economic contribution as much, and we're taking them out of the workforce as soon as they have children, because child rearing is still considered a woman's work. What do you think it would take, as Narina said, whatever wave of feminism we're on, what would it take to get to the fourth wave of feminism and start recognizing women's economic contribution to the point where we adjust policy for them?
I mean, my answer might be different than yours. My answer is to not make this a women's issue anymore, to acknowledge that we live in a world in which men do a huge amount at home, even if they don't do it in exactly the same way that women do it, and even if they don't, we should pretend they do, because it is much better for me to talk about universal precare than to fixate on maternity leave, because universal precare is something that is, you know, equally applicable for men and women, to normalize the idea, again, even if it's not true yet, but just to normalize the idea that this is everybody's problem. It's not just women's problem. This isn't this endless problem that has no name, that just keeps shifting and taking different forms. You know, right now, how is it that women feel duped? It's not because they have to make the beds. It's because, you know, think of the response to the Anne Marie Slaughter article, that, you know, all the women were like, everyone told us we could have it all, but we can't. Turns out we can't. That's the problem that has no name now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think rather than let it just shift in the women camp, like just open it up and let it be everybody's?
I have actually a statistics-based answer, which I totally cribbed from a colleague. I don't do statistics. But Judith Shulevitz.
I'm just a girl. Math is hard.
I'm just a girl. Judith Shulevitz, also a woman, told me recently, and I had never heard this, and it makes all kinds of sense, that the reason that countries that we always cite, the Northern European countries, the, you know, Swedens of the world, the reason that they have such wonderful maternity policies is because their population is not growing at replacement rate, right? They're shrinking. And in the United States, thanks to immigration and things like that, we still are growing at more than replacement rate. And it's not going to be enough of a problem, really, until we're confronted with that actual hard number, and it's going to affect our economy in that way, which I found both depressing and it was sort of nice to have.
No, it's
an
totally
answer.
Great. Yeah. This is the real answer to Ross Douthat, who keeps complaining about the modern American women not having children. It's like a lot of good things will come when the modern American woman stops having so many children. Like then they'll start to deal with some of these issues. They don't do it now because they don't have to, because we have lots of children.
Right.
All right, one more question.
Okay, this this shifts gears a little bit. The Grammys were recent, and the whole Chris Brown Rihanna thing really bothers me.
Like them snuggling in the audience and everything, or just the whole thing?
The whole thing. The whole thing. And I'm wondering. I mean, I don't want to put it on her that, you know, she has like extra responsibility being in the limelight to, you know, move out of that situation. But how do you address this with both the sons and our daughters about how this is not an appropriate relationship, this is not how you're supposed to treat women, this is, you know, how do you treat that when, you know, if there are people that, you know, your kids are going to look up to?
That one's really, really hard. I mean, because
I don't think it's that hard.
Okay,
you know, celebrities
Dear Prudence, love Rihanna.
Celebrities do all sorts of ridiculous things. You might love their song, but the way they live their life, they crack up their cars, they're drug addicts, etc. You separate out, you enjoy their work as an artist, their personal life is a mess. As I said in one of my rules, there's no nice person in the abuser. And I think the message to both sexes, but obviously particularly women, is there's no okay after that. You get beaten up, that's it, it's over. And yes, I think it's terrible to have this kind of role model, well, there's something even romantic about it, kind of, you know, today's version of Stanley Kowalski, but there's so much counter evidence that you can provide, even if you like her song, it's not okay. Getting your jaw broken is getting your jaw broken.
I mean, that's the big difference between Rihanna and Beyonce. Like, I would not let my child watch any of Rihanna's videos. It's not merely her relationship with Chris Brown, right? She's always pushing that question in our faces. And so, you know, it's just, like, what can you say except that is off limits? Like, you can have the Beyonce talk about why she's dressed the way she is and what it is that celebrities do. But Rihanna, you can't, what talk can you have about her videos, you know? Like,
I don't have kids.
You're
something
at
me.
Like, it's like a hard one. Like, no, she is not a role model.
But it is a good occasion maybe to talk about it, right? Not that, you know, that's going to come up necessarily for your kids, but, you know, it's a clear example. That is a really clear example of an
don't
awful
grow
guy.
Up to be like Rihanna. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for
thank
coming
you.
Tonight.
Thank you.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.